All right, everyone. So welcome to the call. I'm so excited to have you here with us. Today, I have a very special guest joining me, and I'm very excited to have you hear more from him. First, some introductions. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Jennifer Blanchard. I'm an author and a story coach. I work with serious emerging novelists who want to save time, be more effective storytellers, and cut years off their learning curve so that they can write kick-ass books and get published sooner. And you can learn more about me at jenniferblanchard.net. And today I have one of my favorite people in the whole world on the line, best-selling author and story coach Larry Brooks. He is obviously very well-known in the writing world. His website is storyfix.com. Larry is the author of several novels, including Darkness Bound and his most recent, Deadly Foe. And most notably, and maybe for me more than anything, is he's the best-selling author of The Writing Guide, Story Engineering. And I consider that book to be the Bible of storytelling. In my opinion, it is just the most amazing book out there on how to write a good story. And I actually found Larry back in 2009 when I was doing my very first novel, and I was looking for what I was missing because I just couldn't make my story work. And I found an article about story structure that he had written on someone else's blog, clicked through, went to storyfix.com, and my whole world was pretty much changed because I learned that story structure existed, which I didn't know about previously. And I honestly don't think I would be where I am right now with, you know, my career as a story coach and with my first novel being published this year if it wasn't for Larry and his work. So I'm just so thrilled to have him here. And he actually has a new book coming out. And it's out on Kindle right now, but its print version is coming out in October. It's called Story Fix: How to Transform Your Novel from Broken to Brilliant. And I got a preview copy of this, and it was just amazing. And my favorite part was that it really gave me a clear understanding of concept and premise. And I think that's something that writers commonly ask me about, and they say they don't understand the difference. So I thought, what a better way to introduce, you know, his book and this concept and premise thing by, you know, bringing him on the line. So welcome, Larry, and I'm so happy to have you here with me.
Hey, good morning, and thank you. I guess it's afternoon elsewhere. I'm in Arizona, where many things are crazy, but one of the craziest things is we're on Pacific time for half the year and mountain time for the other half. Anyway, thank you for having me, and thank you very much for that very gracious and kind introduction. I'm humbled by that, and I'm so glad that my work has reached you and other folks, and I'm happy to talk about this with you all today.
Awesome. So I thought that we could just talk a little bit about concept and premise, and then we could open the line for questions in a little bit.
Sure.
But the number one thing people ask me, or the thing I notice with my people I work with and just people I talk to in general, is that there's a very confused understanding of the difference between concept and premise. So I thought we could start by having you tell us more about what they both are and how they're different.
Sure. You're absolutely right. It is confusing. There's something I call the writing conversation, and when I mention that, I'm referring to the collective noise that we hear and read about writing at conferences, on blogs, on forums, and even in book reviews. And the thing about concept and premise that contributes to the confusion is that even people in the business, people we respect, authors who are wildly famous and successful, will use those terms interchangeably, implying that there is no difference, and or use them incorrectly, implying that the definitions that are accurate are, in fact, not accurate. So that's where the confusion comes from. Also, the fact that nobody has really very much noticed or cared about the difference between concept and premise. So I'm very passionate about it. I found myself writing almost exclusively about this for the past year, and it became kind of the lead focus in my book, although I move on from that in the book. But the whole notion of concept and premise being different is very powerful for writers who will let that in, who will understand that they are different yet interdependent, and to take it one step further, concept is the fuel that makes a premise work. In other words, a premise without an underlying concept driving it is a tough premise to make work. The more genre-focused your story is, the more it's a true mystery, a true romance, a true science fiction, a true thriller, then concept becomes essential. It kind of fades a little bit in the background if we're talking about a literary novel or a character-driven novel to the extent that it's a quote-unquote real-life story. And yet, I think the writer benefits by understanding how the more conceptual we can make our novel, the better. So as we move on, and I know you're going to drive this with questions, Jennifer, I hope to really clarify the difference, and not only that, really sell the importance of concept, because once you understand this, you're going to look at the books that are bestsellers, especially new books from new authors, and they are almost always conceptually driven. And that's the thing that makes a bestseller. It's that core idea that makes a reader go, wow, I've never seen anything like this. That is concept. It's one of several criteria for concept, but that's a big one.
Awesome. Yeah, I always like to say concept is, and I think you say this in your book, but it's the gotta read it factor. It's that thing that makes you want to read the story when you don't even know the character or the plot. And
right.
Then the premise is really the plot of the story. And what happens
right.
in it, you know, that comes from that concept. And that, to me, that's the easiest way to remember the difference.
Right. I love that criteria for concept, and you're absolutely right. Where that gets confusing, though, is that one writer can state her concept and gets that desired response, that being somebody says, wow, I really want to see a story based on that idea. That's a important criteria for concept. Where it gets confusing is you can also pitch someone a premise, and the same listener can say the same thing. Wow, that's a great premise. I really want to read that book. So when that criteria stands alone, it doesn't really differentiate concept from premise, although it is valid for both. But once we understand how concept is different than premise, then we can look back at that criteria and say, now it makes sense, because some premises don't have anything terribly conceptual about them. So the key to this resides in understanding the various criteria for both and how and why they're different, I think.
Perfect. So then let's start in with concept. How else would you define a concept? I like to say it's like the landscape or the setting of a story, but I know that's not always the case, and you talked about this in your book.
Right.
So what other things can be conceptual in a story?
Well, first of all, you're amazingly accurate when you use those terms to describe concept. The reason this is challenging is it is kind of, it's like a cloud. It changes shapes and it moves, and it isn't terribly precise. But if you bear with this one, we can define mm-hmm. concept in conceptual terms. So let's start there. A concept is not the story itself. A concept is a central idea. Think of it as an engine. Think of a car, and if you took the engine out and the engine sat on the ground, that would not be a car. It would just be an engine that is either terribly powerful and wonderful and efficient and fuel efficient, or it's underpowered and weak, and it's just basically a bunch of rubber bands. So you look at the engine alone and you go, that's going to make a great vehicle, or that's not much of an engine for a vehicle. So let's get out of that analogy and look at concept. You're absolutely right. A concept, unlike a premise, is a framework for a story, or think of it in other terms that are descriptive like that. It's a proposition. It's a notion. It's an idea. It's a seed, a spark of something that could turn into a story. It is... as you said, a landscape. I think my favorite one is arena for a story. And let me throw an example at you from a really bad movie. But it's a bad movie that did $1 billion in box office. When Top Gun came out in the 80s, yes, I'm that old, I couldn't wait to go see it. Not because of the story, which is premise. I couldn't wait to go see it because of the concept. And the concept was F-14s taking off of aircraft carriers. That alone made me salivate to see the movie, because I was going to see this thing visually. So from an author's point of view, the arena was fighters taking off of aircraft carriers. The notion was, let's build a story around that. Let's use the power of that appeal, the compelling nature of that conceptual centerpiece, and let's build a story around it. And the story of Top Gun was actually pretty lame. I mean, it was pretty contrived, and they tried to layer two or three plot lines within it. But the central appeal of the story was always those jets. So the criteria, and we should probably, the definition of concept and the criteria for concept tend to sound like the same thing, so I'll kind of merge them anyway. The real criteria is you don't have a character yet. You don't have a plot yet. If you start describing your hero and your plot, you're describing premise. So it's really what about that hero and what about that plot is conceptual in nature. So if you want to think of all this as a funnel and we're pouring all this these criteria into a funnel, what comes out the bottom? And it is this. A concept, and this is going to sound really trite, but it's really clarifying for most people. It's almost miraculous. We can be confused about the word concept. But if I told you that it is merely something conceptual, concept is whatever in the story is conceptual. No plot, no character, not even a setting yet, if that's not your concept. It's what's conceptual. Now you move on from that, and you go, well, what does that mean? What could be conceptual? Well, something conceptual can take many forms. It can actually be a character who is conceptual. But if you're writing a story about, you know, the cashier at Safeway who falls in love, you wouldn't say that's conceptual. It's not. There's nothing about that makes you go, whoa, I want to see that story. But if you write a story about the chief of staff of the White House who has committed a crime, that occupation, the White House, becomes an arena, and therefore it is conceptual. See what I'm saying? So.
Yeah, totally.
There's lots of ways to spin it, but at the end of the day, no matter how you've tried to spin it, the key question is twofold. First question is that conceptual? And the next question is, does it make someone listen to your concept properly described and pitched? No premise yet. If you properly pitch the concept, will someone go, holy crap, I gotta read that novel. I gotta see that movie. That's an arena. That's a notion, a proposition. Now, what's a proposition? Remember the science fiction movies? And I use movies as analogies because they're a two-hour clinic, so we can wrap our head around them real quick. But there was a movie with Bruce Willis where an asteroid was approaching Armageddon, it's called. That was the conceptual proposition. An asteroid is coming to Earth. We have to stop it. That's a conceptual proposition. You don't have a hero yet. You don't really have a story yet. You just have that proposition. So that's one way to frame it. Another way to frame it is the character's conceptual. Superman. It's my favorite analogy for this. Superman. If you say, what's your concept? You go, Superman. You don't have a story yet. There's no story yet. There's no bad guy. There's no villain. There's no stakes. There's just one word, Superman. But that is conceptual. An alien child comes to Earth, is raised by human parents. We come to find out as he grows up, he has superpowers, what we consider superpowers. He has to choose to use them or not to help us or to help himself. There's no story yet. It's just that, and that is conceptual. And that one idea has spawned 10 major movies, a television series that lasted 7 years, a comic book with over 200 editions, and other spin-offs like Supergirl and so forth, Lois and Clark, and those shows, when you total all of those shows and you realize that each and every one of those movies, each and every one of those comic books and TV shows has a different story, there's hundreds of Superman stories, which means there's hundreds of Superman premises, but there's only one concept for all of them. All of them are spun out from the same concept. So another criteria for concept becomes, is the idea rich enough that multiple stories could spring forth from it? That's a really big criteria for a concept. Wow, this concept is so strong, I could tell a dozen stories from it next week. That help?
And you actually gave a great example of that this morning in your email when you sent out about the Limitless movie
right.
being turned into a show now.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if all of the listeners or any of them, in fact, have been on my website this morning, but I wrote a post to link to this phone call. And there's a little story I told. Bradley Cooper was in a movie in 2011 called Limitless. And if you're a TV fan, you may know there's a new TV show coming out this fall called Limitless, which is an extension of the movie, which is another way of saying it's the same concept as the movie. So I give a link to this on YouTube, by the way. Bradley Cooper was on the Late Late Show with James Corden this week, a couple days ago. And with the star of the new TV show. Cooper's not the star of the TV show, by the way, but he is the producer of it. And this rarely happens where a movie star has, you know, it wasn't even that big a hit movie, actually, but it was kind of had its own fan base because it was a pretty cool idea. And they asked him, well, how does this happen? Tom Cruise isn't making TV shows out of his movies and producing them. Why did you do this? And he said, and again, you can see this with the link that I provided on this morning. He said, well, those of us making the movie, the actors and the producers and the crew, were talking about how strong this idea is and how many different stories we could tell from this one idea. So the movie has its concept and then one premise that they chose to make the movie about, but there's so many untold stories from the very same concept that he couldn't shake it, so he decided to create the TV show. So Bradley Cooper has created this TV show called Limitless, which he produces, and because he's Bradley Cooper and a big star, he's gonna make some guest appearances, including the pilot. But he states it very well without even using the word concept, and that's kind of what I said about the writing conversation. Bradley Cooper never uses the word concept, but he does say idea. And if he would have said premise, he would have been mistaken. And that happens all the time. People use the word premise, but they really mean concept, and vice versa. So I encourage you to click onto that clip. And it's kind of illuminating because it's exactly what we're talking about today. The concept was so strong, there's so many more stories we could tell from it. So for a writer, the takeaway is you look at your story and you ask yourself two things. Is there a core notion or landscape or framework in here that is not the story yet? It's just the engine for a story. And have I leveraged that in my premise? Do I have the premise really being about the concept? Every Superman story is about that concept. So, ultimately, at the end of this call, when we put all this together, it really boils down to a handful of criteria and definition bullets that separate it from premise, which I can go through soon if you'd like me to.
Yeah, and actually I was just going to say, so how do you take this concept that you have, let's say someone has a concept, how do they actually turn it into a premise now? What are the criteria for doing that?
Right. Well, that's a loaded question, really, because what you're really asking is, how do we come up with a great story,
yeah.
Which is the biggest can of worms of all? One of the answers to that is, you start with an idea that, a what if, actually, that rocks your boat. And if you're in a genre, the more conceptual that core idea can be, the better. If you're in a kind of just, you know, a literature, a literary fiction, or just adult contemporary niche, then you can get away with saying, well, it's about two people that fall in love, and one of them gets sick, and it's a story about that. That, too, is a concept that just isn't something we've never seen before. In fact, that's something we've seen over and over and over again. So the premise, then, is carrying the weight of everything. In a conceptually driven story, the premise is being bolstered by and driven by and fueled by the concept. So if you look at the definition of concept, it is what we've been talking about. It's a landscape, an arena, a central idea. It's a proposition, a notion, a condition, something like that. And we can come up with a million examples for that. It's when you look at the definition of premise, you realize that it's different. A concept doesn't have a hero in it unless, this is the caveat, unless your hero is conceptual in some way. But if it's Joe or Jane, every person, that isn't conceptual. So you wouldn't put that character in your definition of your concept because it isn't conceptual. Where premise is concerned, you do have a hero. There's a bunch of criteria for a premise. You need a hero. In fact, it's the definition of story, except you're making it specific to your idea. You need a hero. You need that hero to face some sort of quest or mission. They have to need or want something. And that can either be to solve a problem or to seize an opportunity. There must be obstacles in the way of the pursuit of that quest. There must be something at stake in that hero's quest. And the hero must become, through decision and action and the application of courage in some way, often conquering an inner demon that they started with, which is called character arc, the hero has to become the primary catalyst for the resolution of the story's problem. And when everything I said was generic. That applies to every single premise ever done. Those are the criteria. None of that is in your concept, not a bit of it. Because if you set such a story, as I said, in the White House, that's a conceptual arena. So now you've married concept and premise. If you set it on an aircraft carrier, it becomes conceptual. If you set it in a Safeway store, it's not conceptual. See the difference? It's really, what will readers look at and go, whoa, I got to see that story because of that arena or because of that proposition. There's a meteor coming. There's an 800-foot tidal wave coming, something like that in a thriller. There's the terrorists have a bomb, and it's already in the country, and the hero has to find it. That's a concept. But we don't know who the hero is. We don't know specifically what the quest is. We don't know what the villain wants. We don't know what the stakes are, although we can kind of read into it from that. So you can. I hope you can start to see the fuzzy line between concept and premise. And it's fuzzy because a great premise already has a concept built into it, just like a great car has a great engine in it already. But you can pull that engine out and look at it and analyze what makes that a great engine before you add the car. I can overkill analogies all day long, so forgive me if I use too many.
No, that's good. I think I learn more, and I think other people learn more through examples. So one of my favorite things that happens is a lot of times people say, oh, I want to write a love story. And I'm sure you've heard this millions of times.
Yeah.
People say, I want to write a love story about two people who fall in love, and think that that's enough for a story.
Right.
And it's not. So, using that as kind of the beginning idea, a love story, two people mm-hmm. fall in love, how can you take that and really bring something conceptual to it? Because especially in the genre of romance or, women's fiction, we see the same things a lot. And especially right. if it's a love story, certain things are expected. A reader expects a certain type of ending and a certain way of unfolding across the story. So how do you make right. a love story conceptual?
It's a great question, and it's great because romances, because that's really what you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
There's love stories that are truly romances in the genre sense, and then there's love stories that aren't romances. They're love stories that take place in the context to something else that is usually conceptual. But it is the hardest, perhaps, genre to find something conceptual about it. So if you want to make your love story better, work on bringing something conceptual to it. And Nicholas Sparks does this very well. If you wonder why Nicholas Sparks' love stories do better than everybody else's, there's an answer, and the answer is concept. There's always something conceptual about it. So if you look at The Notebook, for example, the concept is two people at the end of their lives, one of them with dementia to the point where she can't recognize her lover, and then the man, the lover, trying to create one last connection between them before she passes. That's the concept. And then the premise shows the love story building from how they met and all the obstacles that they faced. But the conceptual element there was the narrative strategy, wherein it's twofold. It's on two layers. There's a woman dying in a hospital who doesn't know who this man is in front of her. And there's the man deeply in love with this woman he's about to lose. I mean, can you just feel the emotion springing from that? It's a genius concept. And then we intersperse that with seeing how they fell in love and what they had to overcome to get there. And if you look at every Nicholas Sparks story, there's something like that. Somebody returning from war with PTSD, a journal that someone finds and seeks out the lovers in the journal. There's always something conceptual that makes it, yes, a love story, but it makes a conceptual love story. It can be as simple as, instead of having your love story between two people that work at Safeway, use the notion of arena, which is setting, setting being not only place, but also time or culture, and make it a love story among the Amish. That's conceptual. We don't know how those people live for the most part. So it would be interesting to see, go in that culture, and for a lot of people, they'd find that appealing. Or a love story set, I keep using the White House, set on an aircraft carrier between two people. A love story set in a mortuary between people that work in that industry. Take the reader into an arena that we wouldn't ever go to in our real life, and set your love story in a conceptual arena. So arena is a way to make your love story conceptual. Narrative strategy, which The Notebook was, is another way to lend your love story a conceptual essence, if you will. It's hard to do, and it's a great question, but that's the answer, is set your love story in a place that is conceptual, or give one of your characters, which was the case in The Notebook, make one of the characters conceptual. You know, that they come from different religions that prohibit them being together. That's conceptual. Maybe one of them is handicapped and the other one's an athlete. That's conceptual. It's the whole Romeo and Juliet thing, you know, the different classes. That's the concept of Romeo and Juliet. Two kids from warring families fall in love. It's a love story, yes, but what's conceptual about it? Romeo and Juliet's parents is what's conceptual. The classes, the war of the parents is what makes Romeo and Juliet conceptual. So if you just write about two people that work in the back room at Safeway falling in love, you've got your work cut out for you, because that is not conceptual. And in my book, I talk about that very thing happened at a conference. I'd been talking about this very thing all morning, and I saw her being restless, and suddenly she shoots her hand up in the air, and she's practically in tears, and she's almost cussing me out, saying, enough about Superman, enough about, you know, aircraft carriers and all this conceptual stuff. I just wonder, I'm writing a love story about two people. What's this have to do with me? And luckily for me, there was a woman in the room who had just written a best-selling romance. And I looked at her and I said, you want to answer that question? And she said, I'd love to. She said, my love story is based on the fact a woman moves into a house and she discovers a journal. And the journal's from a war veteran. And he's talking about the woman that he loves and he hopes to get home to her. And she said, my character didn't know who they were. So she went on a quest to find out who they are. And she finds the man, and he happens to have a dashingly handsome son that becomes her love interest. But can you see the conceptual narrative strategy in that? She didn't just write about two people that meet and fall in love. There was a conceptual framework for how they came together. And it's interesting, because the second you posit that there's a journal about a war veteran who's going to lose his lover, and you're going to find out who it is, that's conceptual. That makes you just instinct. If you're reading a love story at all, that's going to appeal to you, because that's got the energy of romance just dripping off of it. Yep. So the other woman in the room told the complaining woman about this, and she just said, need to think about it. We took a lunch break, and she came back, and she raised her hand. She says, I think I get it now. She says, I need to change the location and occupation of my players. And she got it, and she was all excited, because she knew how to make her love story conceptual now.
Awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And fun. I think that's important. I mean, I think something I love to do, and maybe it's just because I'm a total story nerd, but I just love watching movies and, like, figuring that stuff out. And I think recently my two favorite, like, conceptual love stories were The Fault in Our Stars, which obviously was a book, too, and then also
right.
If I Stay, which I found out was also a book, which I didn't know after I saw the movie. That being one of my favorites of recently, because that one, you know, it's a love story that's built around this character who basically is in a car accident in this coma and has to decide whether she's going to cross over or she's going to come back, you know? And I love how they did the movie just so, it was amazing and such a good concept for a love story. So,
yeah. Those both are massively conceptual stories.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, one of them is, you know, it goes to the supernatural for its concept, but Fault in Our Stars doesn't. It's about a terminally ill girl falling in love with a terminally ill boy. That's a concept. That's a place we hope we never have to go and live through. But again, if you're interested in love stories, you know, it's, you know, the guy reading a Tom Clancy movie isn't probably going to be drawn to that. But you craft your story and your concept for a target reader. That's what genre is all about. If you're writing in a genre, you're looking for a specific category of reader. So that leads you to a specific type of concept that would appeal to that. Tom Clancy fans are going to want a concept where a submarine is without fuel and stuck in the water, and their only solution is to blow itself up because they happen to be in San Francisco Harbor, and they're going to nuke the whole West Coast. That's a concept. And that's a story also, but it's springing from that concept. So the Clancy fans will go there. The Notebook fans, the Fault in Our Stars fan, won't come to that. They'll come to something else, like a girl killed in a car accident, but she can't move on because she has unresolved issues. That's conceptual. It's way different than just two people meet and fall in love. See what I'm saying? It's the concept that makes these stories work. It's not the premise. It's the concept. Because premise in a romance is almost the same every time. It's the concept that makes a romance or a love story distinguish itself and stand out among a sea of premises that are just little slight twists on each other. They're pretty much the same. Two people meet, they fall in love, there's issues before they can be together, they solve the issues, happily ever after. That's it. That's a romance. What's conceptual about that? It's up to us to put conceptual pieces into that puzzle. It's the same puzzle, but the pieces become conceptual.
Yep, love it. Love it.
Good.
So there are a whole bunch of questions coming in. I'm going to, if anyone on the phone wants to ask a question, hit *2 on your dial so that you can, or your keypad rather. Now I'm going back to like 1990. So hit *2 on your keypad and you can raise your hand to talk to us live and I will read through some of these questions that have come in. And if you want to answer some of them. Do you have to have a love interest in a successful story? I'm writing a historical novel about a murder.
Great question. Most novels need some sort of subtext or subplot. And a love interest makes a character more interesting. It gives them something else to do. So you've already said that your story is a murder story, a suspense story. I don't know if it's a mystery or a thriller. And I don't even know if you know the difference. Let me help. A lot of people don't know the difference between a mystery and a thriller. So let's start there. A mystery is about something that's happened in the past, and someone is trying to solve that and find out the truth about what happened. A thriller is about something that's going to happen in the future or is already happening now, and there's huge stakes to stop the bad thing from happening. Many stories are a hybrid of both. So when you put a character in either one of those, they become immersed in the will I solve the problem aspect. But when they're in love or they're falling in love, because your question is, should I give a love story alongside the thriller? If the love story isn't the thriller, then use the love story to make your hero more empathetic and someone we root for. Have the love story burden him emotionally or her emotionally to the extent that it challenges them to do their job, or a journalist, whatever they're doing, or a spy, on the mystery side of the story. Sometimes, though, the love story is the thriller or is the mystery, and the person you're in love with has been kidnapped, or the person you're in love with is the terrorist or something like that. Then you've already merged. By definition, you've merged the love story. So the trick is knowing which it is. Is it a subplot or is it the main plot? And if you try to make it the main plot when it isn't, when your story is really about a detective trying to find the true killer, a mystery, or a spy trying to find the bad guy before they blow up Paris, then the love story becomes a character-enhancing subplot. So yes, I'm all for it. Love stories are great ways to deepen. You know, we're always looking for ways to make our characters more complex, deeper, more empathetic. And what's more challenging than being in love? Both, you know, it's ecstasy and it's agony at the same time. And that's, if you can bring that to your story and your character, you've probably got a better novel. So go for it, I say.
Awesome. And you mentioned something that I think this question kind of goes along with that, so I'm going to do this one next. It says, I am frequently confused about the distinctions between concept, premise, core dramatic thread, dramatic question, and core story. How do they fit together? And I think maybe there's just wording that are being similarly used. So what would you say to that?
It is confusing. It's why this is hard. I mean, if you look at the stats, I don't like to quote the stats. The stats are terrifying. They're depressing. But we have to be real. 1,000 people submit a novel to a publisher, and 990 of them aren't going to get accepted. 10 are. So what's the difference? And the difference is those 10 understand the question you just asked. So there's no shame in being confused, because it's confusing. It's really hard. I had a neurosurgeon write me and tell me, you know, when you look at it from this story engineering basis and all of the variables and nuances and interplay between the elements, he says it's every bit as complex. The chemistry of a story is every bit as complex as the chemistry of the human brain, because ironically, it is the chemistry of the human brain, because we're talking about people. So it's a great question. So now let's talk about breaking all those up. That is the absolute goal of story engineering. As opposed to someone that doesn't try to break them down and understand them separately and try to do the brain surgery on their story without understanding those separate elements, because they are separate. So I hope, you've been here since the beginning of the call, the person who asked the question, that you're starting to get a handle on the difference between concept and premise. And if that isn't clear to you yet, raise your hand again and we'll pound on it some more. But that's the first differentiation you ask for, concept and premise. And then within premise, you'll recall me saying that the hero has a goal, has a quest, has a mission. Those are synonymous. The hero has to do something. The story isn't, and especially in genre, the story can't be, this is my hero, this is his life, let's write about his life. That doesn't work. The hero has to have something to do, and they do it for a reason. Because there's a ticking clock, or there's urgency, or there's threat, or there's danger, or there's opportunity, and the hero must spring into action and do something. That is a dramatic quest, one of the things you ask for. It's what must the hero do in the story? What are they questing? And what is dramatic about it means that there's opposition in play in the story. Something or somebody is trying to stop them from doing whatever they're doing. And why would they do that? The answer to that is there are stakes. So the dramatic, this is tricky and subtle, so I'm trying to break this down clearly. The dramatic arc, the core dramatic story are the same thing. The dramatic question is simply a way to articulate what your hero is after. And it can be ridiculously simple. So in a murder mystery, the dramatic question often, almost always is, will the investigator find the true killer? That's a dramatic question. Will the hero live long enough to see their child graduate from college? Will the hero beat cancer or not? It's the dramatic question is the thing we're worried about and the thing we're rooting for, because it's the thing that the hero is after. It's what they're trying to do. If you have a quest, it's a succeed or fail proposition. Certainly with some gradations of middle ground or the unexpected, that's certainly plausible in a story. But usually is, will the hero meet the goal or not? That is the dramatic question. So that one isn't complicated. If you understand what your dramatic core story is, then you also understand that my hero has to do something for reasons, which were driven by stakes, against opposition, which is the antagonist slash villain. Will they succeed or not is the dramatic question. All of that brought to life through something conceptual at the heart of the very proposition itself. Does that cover the basis of your question, I hope?
Yeah, I think it does. And core story being the premise. So, yeah, I think it does.
Yes. Good.
All right.
And it's such a great question because you've really asked the question. It's like, how do you make a story work? What goes into a story to make it work? So that's a very important question. I'm glad you asked. And it takes some writers years or even decades to really land on those answers. My whole work is about trying to shorten that from decades to weeks, if you will.
Absolutely. Okay, there's a couple of people with hands raised, but I don't know if you want to go to the live call or do you want me to just read some more questions that are coming in from the web.
Can you say that again? I didn't quite hear you clearly.
Oh, yep. There's two people with their hands raised. Did you want to go to one of the live calls, or do you want me to keep reading some of the questions on the web first?
Hey, I'm a happy guy. Loving this. You do it either way. Whatever works for you, Jennifer.
All right. Let's go to a live call. I'm going to unmute your line. Phone number ends in 5355. You are unmuted. Can you tell us your name and what's your question?
Hello, Larry. This is Joel Canfield.
Hi, Joel. How are you?
I'm excellent. It is gorgeous here in the frozen northwest.
Wow. Okay. It's hot here in the muggy southwest. So.
Yeah. There's a reason I live here and not there.
Right.
So for a data-driven guy like me, more examples, especially from movies, would be marvelously helpful. This might be too long an answer for the phone call, but I would love to see at StoryFix, a handful of your favorite movies. Here's the concept. Here's the premise. And, in fact, the other parts broken out, the dramatic question, all the bits. Even a half a dozen examples from a few different genres would just be marvelously helpful to us data-driven folks.
Sure. I could talk about that all day. I'll try not to do that. We've talked about two movies already. We've talked about Top Gun, and we've talked about The Notebook. So let me go to another best-selling novel that became a fabulously successful movie, The Help. Let's tick through these. The concept of The Help is an arena. It's 1962 Jackson, Mississippi, which is fraught with culturally acceptable racial bias. That's an arena. Before you add character, before you add a story of any kind, many people would go, whoa, that was a scary place. I'm glad I didn't ever go there, but I'd love to see a story from there. I would love to see a character triumph in that horrific cultural arena. So it checks off. It meets the criteria there. That's a killer arena. That's a great concept. But we don't have a premise yet. We don't have a hero. We don't have a villain. We don't have anything going on. We just have the arena. So the arena, when you look at it, the concept is dripping with potential drama and emotional resonance, right? Because we should be outraged by the culture of 1962 Jackson, Mississippi. So we leverage the emotional richness of the concept, and we create a story around it. And the story around it, the premise was this. It's a story about a 20-something rich white girl who grew up with the colored, using her word, colored maids, and she loved her maid as much as her socialite. She loved her socialite mother, who was busy doing other things. So this character has empathy for all of the colored maids who work for the rich people in Jackson, Mississippi, in 1962. But interestingly enough, that was never her core motivation to start. Her core motivation is she wanted to be a journalist. She had a career goal. So she has an idea that she contacts an uppity editor in New York, and she gets the opportunity that if she can write a book about this culture that works, she'll have her career as a journalist. So Skeeter's goal is to write a book about the colored maids and their life in Jackson, Mississippi. We're still in the part one setup. This is all established as what she's going to try to do. So that's your premise. Skeeter needs to write a book that works. But when you look at the criteria for premise, I haven't ticked off all the boxes yet, so let's start ticking them off. What is the opposition to this? Well, the opposition is the colored maids don't want to talk to her. They don't want to talk to this she's a very sweet, nice person. They get that, but they don't want to talk to her because if they start telling the stories about how they're treated by these rich white people, they're going to lose their job. They're going to get in trouble. In fact, the racism is so severe that they might even be harmed or killed, and they know it. So they all go silent. And there's a narrative strategy. If you've read my book, Story Physics, you know there's six elements of story physics, and one of them is narrative strategy. And it's how are you going to tell the story? And the narrative strategy here was also brilliant and conceptual in itself, in that Catherine Stockett, the author, used three different first-person present narrators. And one of them was Abilene, who's kind of the core dual protagonist. One of them was, I can't remember her name now, help me out if anybody knows, the other narrator who was also one of the maids, and she was a little more feisty. And then there was Skeeter herself. So they became the opposition to Skeeter's goal. The stakes here, interestingly enough, if you look at this closely, the stakes here, Skeeter was never going to solve racism in 1962 Jackson, Mississippi. That was too big. The stakes were, will Skeeter get this book written, and will she get her journalism career? And then those stakes are deepened when these women decide to help her because they're fed up. The author does a good job of showing us why they need to speak their mind. This has to be brought out, how they're treated. And will they be safe? Will they keep their jobs? Will this wreck their lives? And these are very human, emotionally resonant stakes. Everything in here is strategically emotional. So that's a nuance of writing a great book. How are you pulling the strings of the reader's emotions? It isn't just what's interesting. It's what are you making the reader feel? How are you pissing them off? How are you touching their heart? How are you making them fall in love with your characters? How are you making them feel the angst of pursuing a lifelong dream and having huge problems in your way? These are human things that we can get. We understand this. So we create a microcosm in our book where the reader feels the same things that the characters are. So that becomes the premise. Now, remember I talked about the premise, the concept, I'm sorry. I talked about the concept. There is no character in that. It's a place. It's a culture. It's a society. That's the concept. No hero, no quest, no villains, nothing. Then when you go to premise, you see how that concept is the fuel that drives everything in the premise. And that's why it was so brilliant. So that's the premise. Skeeter needs to write this book. Her first problem is she has to get the maids to talk to her. The second problem is the maids have to stay safe and tell the story to the world. And when it comes out, there are indeed consequences, not only for the maids, but for the white people that try to get back at them and get revenge for being humiliated publicly in a book, which is a delivery of satisfaction to the reader. Again, the author brilliantly pulled our emotional strings when we saw these horrible, horrible white people get what's coming to them in a form of humiliation, because now the world knows who they are. And I hope that answers your question, Joel. That's why I can't really do six of these, because I just spent 10 minutes doing one
sure.
of them.
But, sure. Premise is reasonably easy for me because there is that checklist that you provided. And
right.
The concept here is fascinating because this is one of those cases you mentioned where the concept is sort of the setting. That place and time instantly evokes pictures that a reader can jump onto.
Right, right. And what makes concept tricky is it isn't always the setting. Sometimes concept is something else. Superman isn't a setting.
Sure.
And so the concept really is an idea that stands alone before you add the story and glows in the dark and makes you go, wow, I want to see that story. Give me a story, and then give me another story, and then give me another story after that, because this idea is so compelling. I want to hear stories about it. Another story, I don't know if you're watching it, I just finished the 3 seasons of Orphan Black on cable TV, one of the best shows I've ever seen. It's 30 different episodes, 30 different premises, all based on one idea, and it has to do with cloning. And it's fascinating. And it's basically somebody creates clones, and somebody the key science for that is lost, so they have to find the clones themselves and use their DNA, i.e. kill them and chop them up and study them. And it's about how these clones band together to survive and find the bad guys and stop this conspiracy. Killer idea. Panic. And it's the, you see, once you understand this, you see it never vary. It's a killer concept driving a killer premise. And the killer, I don't know if people relate to that word, you can come up with mundane concepts and mundane premises, and one or both could be brilliant or mundane, and the goal is to shoot for something that is stellar in both senses, conceptually and dramatically, which means premise.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, thanks,
Joel.
That's
great.
Yes.
And I'll write more about this. You know, I know you read StoryFix religiously, and I really appreciate that. And I'll continue to throw out examples that, because that is the best way to clarify this. It sounds great when I'm sitting there preaching it, but it's hard to do. It's very hard to do. So the doing becomes more accessible when we see how somebody else did it.
Agreed. All right, I'm going to mute your line again. Okay, we have one more person with their hand up, so I'm going to go to that. It's a web call, Trisha. I'm unmuting your line. Are you there?
Yeah, but I don't see my line unmuted. Can you hear me?
Yes.
We can hear you.
Okay, great. Okay, this is something I actually asked you, Larry, a couple years ago in an email, and you sounded amenable to the idea, but I haven't seen it yet on StoryFix.
Okay. Sorry.
It's okay. I'm like really a neophyte, and so I write short stories at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I just want to know, are there any differences, you know, between all the story engineering bits and pieces and the general teachings as they apply to a short story?
Mm-hmm. Great question.
Is that question clear?
Yeah, it is. It is.
Okay.
Yes and no. How's that for specificity? Yes and no. And
well, I'm sure you're going to explain it. So.
Yeah, dive into that a little bit. There's really only two forms of a short story. One is it's a condensed version of the full story arc, this full four-part story arc. And in that condensation, you can actually almost imply something in the sequence, which is set up, first plot point, story launched, hero response, story changes again, proactive attack on the problem, story changes again, resolution. That's the four parts with three milestones in it. You can compress that into the 10 pages of a short story and write your short story that way. And that's full structure compressed. So in that sense, it is exactly the same, except the short story writer can cover what would be 100 pages of narrative in a book and do it in one sentence, because if it's a good enough sentence, if they understand the story to the degree, they need to cover the base. However, there's another way to write a short story, and that is to pluck a microcosm part of that out and write that as a short story. So if you think of a story as a human life, the first one would be we start at birth, we see the childhood, the adolescence, the young adult, the middle age, the beginning of old age, and then the old age, and then death. That's the full arc of a life. You can do that in a short story. However, you can also write a short story about someone graduating from high school. And in that story, you would only cover the span of a week. It isn't their whole life. However, we need the implication of everything that came before and the implication of everything that's going to come after. Otherwise, the story has no meaning for us. Who is this person? That's everything that came before. Why is this decision or thing happening to them in this 1 week going to change who they are and affect who they are going forward? That's the rest of their life. Short stories are harder to write than a novel. I contend that. I believe that. And it's because it's so hard to pull off what I just described, but that's how you do it. You either compress the full arc of a full story and cover it all in 10 pages or 18 pages or 4 pages. It's hard to do in 4 pages. Or you select a microcosm someplace along that arc and find the subject matter conceptual. Yes, conceptual. And you imply or you create a context of what's happened before and what will happen after. And that can all happen in a half a sentence. You know, Jane was an abused child and here she is in her first love affair. That's one sentence. We don't need to see the first 18 years of her life. That one sentence covers it. But we do want to write a short story about that first date where she's terrified but hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so many ways to spin a short story. It's more like a poem in a sense that in poetry, one line speaks volumes. And in short stories, one sentence can and should speak volumes.
Mm-hmm.
And then in other places, full paragraphs are descriptive and they don't really say anything contextually. So it's a different art form. It's a hard art form. It's a noble art form. And but when you drill down, you're either telling the full arc of a story or you're lifting a moment from the life of a story and making that. But even then, you need to imply dramatic tension. You need to have something conceptual making it interesting. You need to have the hero involved, making decisions, taking action. There needs to be stakes. There needs to be opposition. All of those elements are still there, but more contextually, perhaps, in a short story.
Contextually, you think?
Yes.
Okay.
A lot of things
okay.
can be context.
Mm-hmm.
So you've asked a loaded question. There's a whole book to be written about this, and, you know, I just gave you 4 minutes on it, so I can't. You know, I probably can't make it as clear as you'd like or that I would like, but that's my shot at it.
No, but that is very helpful. Thank you.
Good.
He has an article on his website as well, storyfix.com, about short story structure, if you want to check it out.
Oh,
right.
I never saw that. Do you know the title of it?
I don't.
off the top of my head, I don't. Are you in the Emerging Novelist Incubator group on Facebook?
No, I know this sounds like really, I would if it wasn't Facebook, but I don't do Facebook.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. I'll add a link to that article into the, when I send out the replay after the call from
okay,
this,
thanks.
I will add the link to the article so you can have it in there.
Thank you very
also,
much.
Also, Patricia, on my site, there's a search function. It's in the upper right part of the,
okay.
of the right-hand column. And you can just put short story in there, and it'll take you right to any post. I have 800 posts up. Some of them, Jennifer's right, there's one that really focuses on the very question you asked. And there's other posts that reference short stories. And when you put short story into the search, you'll get all the posts that reference short stories.
Okay, thanks. You know, I love that you mentioned some of the movies you mentioned are some of my favorite stories, you know. And I love that
uh-huh.
you mentioned The Fault in Our Stars. You know, because
yes.
even though it's like, I thought it was awesome that this guy wrote, he lives in the city I grew up in, by the way. He wrote this story that young people just loved. I live in Brazil and it sold a lot in Portuguese in Brazil also. And, and it wasn't paranormal and it wasn't Harry Potter.
Right.
And it, you know, it was just people, you know, I just loved that, you know.
Yeah. And yet it was conceptual. Because the story
oh,
wouldn't
yeah.
work the same way if it was just two high school kids rather than
no,
two
no,
sick high school
course,
kids.
Of course, but the thing is, it was real people, and it wasn't, you know, it
right.
was real life.
Yeah. Well, that just proves the point that concept doesn't have to be supernatural, it doesn't have to be Superman, and it doesn't have to be Jeff on an aircraft carrier. It can be
yeah.
real people in real life, but
yeah.
people are drawn to something conceptual about those real people.
Right, and he was successful with young people who had, like, the main things that had been successful with young people were all those other things for years now.
Right. You know, what yeah. makes people drawn to a concept is it's a desire that they either already have or would like to have. So if you look at the other Small Towns book by the same author, did you read that?
No.
Yeah, well, that movie's out. It's quite good. You should rent the movie. It's real people, real kids, and the concept is real life. It's like, what if you grew up with a girl and you secretly loved her, and then she moved on, and you realize you don't have resolution. You have to find her, and your quest becomes to find this girl you grew up with. You know, that's not supernatural. That's not terminal illness,
right.
but it is conceptual.
Yeah.
It is a framework for a story
right.
that people go, wow, that sounds interesting. I want to live that story, and that's the key. Reader goes, I want to be in that story for 300 pages.
Yeah.
Because it is conceptual. So those are good examples. Yeah, and relatable.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Unmute your line. And let's see. Okay, so that was all the hands. There's a bunch more questions in the Q&A online. I don't know how much more time you have. It's the top of the hour, so I don't want to overstep the time. But if you have some more, I've got some more questions coming through if you want to.
I do have more time, and I would suggest this, Jennifer. If you would send me the questions we don't get to, I will write some answers, and you can, I'll do that quickly, and you can send those out with the transcript.
Okay, cool.
How's that?
All right, so I will just go through a couple of them. Well, here's one that came in. This person is saying, I won't read the whole question because it's kind of long, but basically what they're saying is, I'm a Panther, and so I'm not really concerned about the timing that it takes me to write something. So why is it important for me to save time if the goal is to write a good book instead of a fast book? And before you say anything, I would say, you know, for me, it took me 18 years to write and publish my novel. 18 years, from the first day that I dreamed of it to actually making it happen. And I don't know about you, but do you really want to take 18 years to get your book out there? Because I don't think you do. And so that's why learning this stuff ahead of time and knowing about story structure and learning what it takes to write a good story is, even if you're a Panther, and even knowing this stuff, regardless of how you're going to get to your story, knowing what it's going to take, it's just going to make it easier for you and cut years off of the time that it will take you to get a good story out there. And, I mean, I don't know, everybody's got their own time frames on things, but I just think that the sooner you can learn what you don't know and start applying it to your work, the sooner you can become better and get to that dream you have of being published. So I don't know what you would say about that, Larry, but I mean, that's what I would say.
I like your response. Yeah, in a way, the question implies that the goal of this discussion and story engineering and the whole criteria-based, mission-driven storytelling in general is to make the process faster. That is not the goal. It's the result. It happens, but it's not the goal. The goal for a Panther, and I used to be accused of this, and it's less true now than ever. I'm not advocating outlining over pantsing. This isn't about process. You do any process you want, whatever works for you. If you're a pantser, God bless you. Stay pantsing. That's great because that's your chosen process. However, just like anything else, you can do it from a knowledge base, and or you can do it where pantsing for some people means I don't really know how to write a story, but I'm just going to sit down and try. That's bad pantsing. That's just clueless storytelling. And we were all in that spot when we start. So the goal isn't to turn you into anything other than an enlightened, informed, educated pantser, so that when you do your pantsing, you understand the structures of a story that need to be there when it finally works. So that instead of writing like the uninformed pantser for years and dozens of drafts, and you start to move closer and closer to that target format and structure because you get feedback and you make corrections, that's all feedback does. It moves you closer to the criteria of a good story. So when you know that criteria and your pantsing is done in context to what you know, it will shorten your timeline. So the speed with which you write is a fortunate result, not necessarily the goal. It'll just happen. So your pantsing will be more effective immediately. You know, Stephen King can write a first draft that works, not because he's lucky. He's a total pantser. He can do it because of what he knows. He knows how a story starts. He knows what a first plot point is. He knows where it goes. And the story he pantses, the story that dumps out of his head onto a page, goes onto the page just like that. So I could rant about this for a long time. Let me leave you with one thought. The criteria for an effective story are no different for a pantser than they are for a complete right brain, anal retentive outliner. They're no different. It's exactly the same criteria. So it makes sense to know the criteria, to honor the criteria, and when you pants, those criteria become the contextual guidelines for what you're pantsing. And when you do that, the whole process will get much, much shorter. You agree, Jennifer?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I hope that helps.
Absolutely.
Keep passing. It's awesome.
I say what works for you, you know.
Absolutely. I mean,
but the problem is, in
light of what works.
Right, exactly. I was going to say the problem is that what works isn't always, sometimes people think that pantsing is working for them, but it's really not because they're not getting anywhere. They're not ever finishing anything or, you know, getting to the resolution of like, I'm finished with this book. I'm going to publish it now. You know, you just keep writing forever.
Right.
And that was what I was running into, you know, in 2008 when I first started this whole writing my book thing.
Right. You know, there's two outcomes from writing that way. One is, for an uninformed pantser, one is, hey, I think I'm done, and what you finished doesn't align with the criteria, or I don't know if I'm done because I don't know the criteria, so I'll just keep writing. Both of those are bad outcomes. So that's what Jennifer, I think you did for 18 years. You didn't know if you were done because you didn't have criteria in your head that allowed you to realize that you've met the criteria and now I'm finally done.
Right, because I'd written so much stuff. I mean, I started this when I was 13. I wrote my first novella, and it was like I kept going, and until I got very serious about studying story back in 2009 and just really making it part of who I am as a person, it just becomes now, you know, structure jumps off the page at me, jumps off the screen at me because it's just ingrained in me now. But before that, I couldn't have written a good story to save my life. Now, the stories come to me in structure. Like, I get first plot points in my head for things like, oh, that's okay, like, I can do that. Or, you know, so for me, it's been huge to not just have a process, but also to just know what I need to know about my story before I write it, regardless of how it gets written.
Right. And what's great is, was it Patricia that asked that question, you said?
That was a question from the web.
Okay. What's great about the whole notion of criteria is that when you read a book that works, it always meets the criteria. It works because it meets the criteria, and that's not an accident. So why would anybody not want to know the criteria in the name of pantsing? I mean, most people start out as a pantser, which means when we start out, we don't know anything. So some people continue to be uninformed pantsers. As the knowledge comes to them and they start to see it and they realize it's valid, really the pantsing becomes more hybrid because they know certain things have to be in certain places in the story. And if you don't believe that statement, prove it wrong. You can't. Go out and find a commercially successful modern novel and certain things are in the same place every time, functionally in the story. You know, John Green's books, The Hunger Games series, The Help, Jonathan Franzen, all of them. It's the same structure every time. So if you're pantsing something that isn't that structure, it's not going to work. So go ahead and pants, but find the criteria and learn them, and your pantsing will absolutely light on fire, and everything will be different, and including the timeline, which is what you asked about.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. There's a couple of questions that are asking for examples, so I'll send you those after the call, and you can, you know, respond to them separate so we don't have to go through more examples. But here's a question. This is specific to her story. Do you want me to ask this one, or do you want me to send that along?
I don't care what works online there. I mean, if it's...
Okay. I mean, I'm good with time, so... And if the recording's going, if anyone wants to jump off and come back and listen to it later, I'm going to send the link out, so you're good. Okay, so she says, in my time travel novel, is my time travel and the object of time travel the concept, or is the journey my main character goes on to save her childhood time travel friend from Bedlam the concept?
Well, it's a great question. I hope you've been here since the beginning of the call because you should be able to answer the question at this point. Time travel is the concept. What happens to your hero is the premise. And it's really kind of that simple. That's the differentiation between concept and premise. What is the core idea, the notion, the proposition? And then, in premise, who is my hero, what's the problem, and what do they do? Which is exactly what you just asked. So it's really a simple answer. It's a good question, but it doesn't have to be complicated in your head. Time travel is conceptual. Because remember what I said? What is a concept? It's something that's conceptual. There's nothing more conceptual than time travel. So that alone, I've got a time travel story. People will go, oh, I hate time travel, or they'll go, oh, I love time travel. You got them. You got them. You've got an engine for your story, time travel. Now, what you do with that in terms of your hero is premise. And that's why this is way simpler than people seem to think that it is. It's very simple. It's what's the idea that makes this work, time travel, and then what has to work, character with a problem, journey, need, villain, stakes, and outcome. That's premise. So, and you've got it. You just stated both of those, and you've got the basis covered, so good on you. You know, if you're writing a time travel story, stop worrying about concept. It's already conceptual. You got it. You can check that one off.
Okay. Here's an example that I think this might get us into something, but it says, a woman abandons her children, which results in each of those children developing hang-ups about love and family when they mature. Is this a concept upon which to write a romance?
Sort of. I think it could be made more conceptual by answering these questions. Who are they? What station in life are they? Where do they live? What's their social arena? What makes them conceptual? Because what you just stated is generic. A woman is generic. Children are generic. Afterlife problems because of their upbringing, those are all generic things. So they're not terribly conceptual yet. Now, it's good, and it may be good enough. You know, not all stories require high concepts. When the concept which you have isn't high concept, and it isn't because it's generic, you can bring it to life through a very well-executed premise. And the reason that's a good one for that is that people, even your unspecific and generic concept is already emotionally resonant, because most of us have lived something like that. Most of us carry baggage from our childhood. So in a sense, yes, you do have a concept, but you really need to have very high craft in your premise and execution to make it work, because there isn't anything about the concept that is unique or different. We've seen baggage from childhood stories, you know, they're everywhere. So because your story doesn't distinguish itself conceptually, you can distinguish it through your execution, because it is a kind of a universal, if not unique, concept.
Yeah, and I think the baggage from childhood thing really just lends itself to an inner demon more than anything else.
Sure, yeah. And these are all
inner demon.
Right, these are all basic elements of fiction, which is why I say, don't hear that as a criticism, by the way. When I say it isn't uniquely conceptual, I don't mean that critically. It's just that's the challenge of romance, is that it's hard to bring something to it. So look at your narrative strategy, and maybe that's conceptual. Just like, if you want an example, The Notebook by Nicholas Sparks, how he told the story is conceptual. So you have the opportunity to make a generic concept, and a strong one like yours, because it is strong. You can make the overall execution conceptual by how you narrate it. You can have multiple narrators from those kids. You can have the mom be a narrator. You can have these colliding points of view through the narration. That's conceptual. So you have the opportunity, just like Catherine Stockett did in The Help, to use how you narrate as a tool that is conceptual. You know, we think of conceptual as something about the story. Well, it can also be something about how the story is told. That help?
I love it. Yes, I love it.
Good.
All right, let's see. There are a few more. Some of these I can send you after to answer, because I think are going to take a little bit longer. So,
okay.
Let's see. How do you know if this person says, how do you know if your concept is strong enough? What makes it compelling enough? Can the story carry some of the weight? Example, where concept and story are equal in strength, or should the concept drive the story always? Is uniqueness the main factor?
Well, one other way to express your question is, what makes something high concept and something generic concept? And you just heard that in the last question and the answer to it. This is always one's perception. You know, what makes somebody more beautiful than somebody else? It's all just perception. So how, what makes one, beauty and high concept are kind of analogous terms. What makes your concept more beautiful than another concept? And it's in the eye of the beholder. So that's why some readers don't like Superman stories. It's too high concept. They're not drawn to it. And they prefer two people falling in love stories, real life stories that are made conceptual with some sort of contextual nuance about who they are, where they are, a place we've never been before. That is fresh and unique. So really, there's no pat answer to your question, how do you know? How does any writer know that their book is good enough? That's why not everybody gets published. I mean, it's really the sum of everything we've learned with the sum of everything we've tried. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. High concept is the degree to which we've never seen this before, or the degree to which, like in The Help, it pushes emotional buttons. So there's two kind of criteria-based questions for you about your concept. You're wondering if it's high enough. Have we seen it before? Is it familiar to the point of being generic, like the last story we talked about was, last question, and or what emotional buttons does it push, and are those extreme? You know, a story of, you want high concept? A story about child abuse. That's it. That's an arena. And buttons are pushing all over the place when you say that, because it's so horrific. So that's a sure thing. So other concepts aren't a sure thing. So look at your concept and ask, how original is this? How, oh my God, never seen that before, is it or not? And then if not, you can still make it highly conceptual by what proven universal buttons does it push? And that's why the Da Vinci Code worked, by the way. People hated it, and they went and bought the book because they hated the idea so much. It pushes buttons. So are you pushing buttons? I mean, what emotional, think of emotion as arena. Child abuse is an arena. Spousal abuse is an arena. Infidelity is an arena. These are all button pushers. So are you pushing buttons? A story about abuse, that's generic as hell, isn't it? But it will work because people care about it. They're involved emotionally right away. So that's the other opportunity in concept. It isn't just how cool and new and, you know, aircraft carriers and fighter jets it is. It's, wow, this is a life I've led, or this is a life I hope I never have to lead, and I really care about this, and I want that criteria applies in both cases. Wow, this is a story I want to read. And if you can answer that question, if it's intense enough, stellar enough on those counts, then it doesn't have to be high concept. It's when neither one of those are in place that the whole burden becomes on execution, and people go, yeah, it was good because it was so well written. But before the fact, you can't pitch that. You're going to love my book because it's so well written. You can't pitch that. You need more to go on when you're pitching. You need to make a promise. A concept and a premise are both a promise to the reader. Think of it that way. What are you promising them? And if it boils down to, well, there's nothing unique about my story, and it really isn't all that emotionally resonant, but you're going to love it because I'm really going to write it well. That doesn't work, does it? So go back to what will make them want to read it. And sometimes that falls into premise because it's just such a fascinating sequential story you're telling here. Hope that helps.
Yeah. Someone is saying concept equals tension. Would you say that that's true?
Concept equals tension?
Mm-hmm.
Concept perhaps equals the potential for tension, yes.
Okay, so no tension, no concept.
Yeah, but premise is the place where tension is dealt with. Premise is where you come up with a problem. You define a problem that your hero has, and that is inherently tense or isn't. So that's where the button for that is. It's really not in concept. You know, a story told in the White House, there's no tension there yet. So concept does not equal tension, and yet a story told in the White House would be very, very interesting to people, so it works even without the tension. Now you have to bring the tension to it in the premise. Premise is where dramatic arc and core story and dramatic question and hero's quest, all of these things that equal drama. It's in premise, not necessarily in concept. However, in concept, it can be obviously implied and inevitable, or not. But that isn't incumbent upon the premise, even though it can occur from the premise, from the concept. It isn't incumbent upon the concept to be dramatic, even though it often is. See what I'm saying? That's why this is hard. There's different outcomes and different ways to spin concept. The only thing that's consistent is this an idea that lights up in the dark and fuels whatever premise you attach to it? That's the primary criteria. Is the idea strong enough? And two people falling in love in Safeway isn't an idea that's strong enough. Two people falling in love from opposite political parties at a political convention where one guy intends to disrupt and the other is an advocate, but they fall in love anyway, that's a conceptual idea. So, no, concept doesn't equal dramatic tension. Premise equals dramatic tension.
Perfect. There's two more. So this one says, Beverly Hillbillies, would the concept be something like fish out of water and the premise would be family of hillbillies striking it rich and moving to swanky Beverly Hills?
Both of those are concept. There's no story
yet. I was going to say there's no story yet.
Yeah, I mean, when you said fish out of water, that's a thematic start, but the concept is the latter. You know, hillbillies move to Beverly Hills. That's conceptual. That's interesting. Right away, that's interesting. There's no story yet. There's no villain. There's no quest. But it is ripe for that. It fuels that. I mean, it immediately leads to how many years did that run? Let's say it ran 7 years at 26 shows each. That's, 170-some-odd premises, all of them different, based on one concept. These examples are good. These are good.
Yeah, definitely. So, okay, this person is asking, is it possible to revive an overdone concept, for example, vampires, shapeshifters, et cetera, by making it more conceptual?
Well, I think reality proves that it is possible. We keep getting vampire stories, and they keep working. So there's some concepts that are so good that just a little twist on them makes it ripe. You know, Twilight's twist was a vampire falls in love with a beautiful human girl. I mean, that's it. That's the concept. And while there are characters there, they're conceptual characters. One of them's a vampire, and the other's a human who falls in love with a vampire. So they're conceptual already. There's no story yet. You don't have a specific hero with a specific problem, with a specific thing to do, a specific villain, and specific stakes. Those aren't there yet. They're implied, but they're not there yet. So the answer is yes, absolutely. If you take a universal concept, it's become its old. Those become their own subgenre. Vampire novels are their own subgenre. Time travel is its own subgenre. They're actually genres, and genres equal conceptual. So, go for it. It's, come up with a new twist in the premise for an old proven concept that still is glowing in the dark. Absolutely.
Oh, here's another one that just came through. I'm talking about the help again. So I'll just read this one. You discussed Skeeter's ultimate goal of getting her book written. When framing the concept and premise of your story, can you, as the author, have an ultimate goal for your protagonist that the protagonist doesn't initially start with? For instance, the protagonist starts off wanting to catch the perpetrator of a crime she witnesses, but her goal changes when she is forced to go up against a secret cable. I don't know what that means, but...
That is totally possible. It's frequent, and it is, in fact, what the premise is about. A hero starts out wanting one thing, but because X happens, the goal shifts to something else. It's that's a structural-based thing. The first part, the first quartile of the story is a setup, and your hero wants something in that setup often. Sometimes they don't, but they can. And then the story changes either at the first plot point or the midpoint, and their goal shifts to something else based on what the contextual environment and need is. And that is story arc. So what you just described is not only good and valid, it's a fundamental. Is that the story has to grow and evolve. And sometimes that's a drastic change of course on the part of the hero. Now, what doesn't work, and I've seen this, is the story starts out being one thing and it becomes something else altogether. Like someone has to travel to the East Coast to find their missing sister. And in the layover in St. Louis, they fall in love with somebody, and instead of going to the sister, they go to Miami and go to the beach. That's bad if the story changes to something else. It has to be an organically natural transition based on, motivated by, resulting from what's happened to them in the pursuit of the first goal that moves that goal to something else, something higher usually. You know, I need to go find my missing sister, and when I find her, she's involved in a drug situation in school, and now the goal becomes to clean up the drug situation in the school. That's an example of an organically valid change in goal. And it's rich stuff. It's a very good way to ratchet up the stakes, ratchet up the tension when the goal shifts to something bigger and more dangerous, if you will, where the threat and the stakes are higher.
And I think really it should do that in some ways, because that,
yeah,
you know, brings it to a different level.
Right. Taking it to a different level doesn't have to be a change, though. So it can spin either
sure.
way, but you're absolutely right. This, things should ratchet up. Pace increases, stakes increase, urgency, threat, all of those can increase. But sometimes they result in a higher ultimate outcome goal for the hero than what they started with, or not.
Very awesome. There is two more questions in the box, and then I think we've hit them all. So,
okay.
Did you want to go through them quick, and then we can wrap it
up?
Yeah,
let's do it. Let's do it.
All right. This person says, high concept doesn't seem to easily cover some ideas. Would you give us an example using an indie movie that's character driven versus action plot to show this?
Okay.
I mean, what about that book you deconstructed, or the movie you deconstructed, that I feel like is kind of like that too, 500 Days of Summer.
Right. Yeah, 500 Days of Summer is a good example. The concept was the execution. Remember I said narrative strategy can be conceptual? Well, this author, screenwriter, told a story. It's really a simple love story. Boy meets girl. Boy falls in love with girl. Girl responds halfway, but isn't as serious about it as he is. So she breaks his heart, and he tries to get her back. Now, that could be told in a straightforward manner, right? And then it would be, you could honestly say, well, that's fine, but I've seen that a million times. It's nothing new. So he spun this in a narrative way that is totally new and compelling, up to and including the title. Because 500 Days of Summer, summer is not a season. Summer is the name of the girl. And the 500 days is the length of their relationship, or better stated, the length of his pursuit of a relationship with her. And then in the sequence of the narrative, everything is non-sequential. Like, I can't quote this because I don't have it exact, but for example, the first scene could have been, and it's actually labeled as day 72, and the next scene could be day 240, and then the third scene could be day 12. It's told non-sequentially. And yet, contextually, the four contextually driven parts of the story and the goals of the three major milestones are absolutely honored. They do exactly what they're supposed to do. But narratively, the author found a new way to tell the story, which is exactly